him, insisted on going last until they reached the street. But there his own robust rapidity asserted itself unconsciously, and he walked quickly on ahead towards the railway inquiry office, talking to the others over his shoulder. "It is jolly to get some pals," he said. "I've been half dead with the jumps, being quite alone." I nearly flung my arms around Gogol and embraced him, which would have been imprudent. "I hope you won't despise me for having been in a blue funk." "All the blue devils in blue hell," said Syme, "contributed to my blue funk. But the worst devil was you and your infernal goggles." The young man laughed delightedly. "Wasn't it a rag?" he said. "Such a simple idea. Not my own. I haven't got the brains. You see, I wanted to go into the detective service, especially the anti-dynamite business. But for that purpose, they wanted someone to dress up as a dynamiter, and they all swore by blazes that I could never look like a dynamiter. They said my very walk was respectable, and that seen from behind, I looked like the British Constitution. They said I looked too healthy and too optimistic and too reliable and benevolent. They called me all sorts of names at Scotland Yard. They said that if I had been a criminal, I might have made my fortune by looking so like an honest man. But as I had the misfortune to be an honest man, there was not even the remotest chance of my assisting them by ever looking like a criminal. But at last I was brought before some old josser who was high up in the force and who seemed to have no end of a head on his shoulders. And there the others all talked hopelessly. One asked whether a bushy beard would hide my nice smile. Another said that if they blacked my face, I might look like a Negro anarchist. But this old chap chipped in with a most extraordinary remark. "A pair of smoked spectacles will do it," he said, positively. "Look at him now. He looks like an angelic office boy. Put him on a pair of smoked spectacles, and children will scream at the sight of him." And so it was, by George. When once my eyes were covered, all the rest, smile and big shoulders and short hair, made me look a perfect little devil. As I say, it was simple enough when it was done, like miracles, but that wasn't the really miraculous part of it. There was one really staggering thing about the business, and my head still turns at it. "What was that?" asked Syme. "I'll tell you," answered the man in spectacles. "This big pot in the police who sized me up so that he knew how the goggles would go with my hair and socks. By God, he never saw me at all." Syme's eyes suddenly flashed on him. "How was that?" he asked. "I thought you talked to him." "So I did," said Bull brightly, "but we talked in a pitch-dark room like a coal cellar. There, you would never have guessed it." "I could not have conceived it," said Syme gravely. "It is indeed a new idea," said the professor. Their new ally was, in practical matters, a whirlwind. At the inquiry office, he asked with businesslike brevity about the trains for Dover. Having got his information, he bundled the company into a cab and put them and himself inside a railway carriage before they had properly realized the breathless process. They were already on the Calais boat before conversation flowed freely. "I had already arranged," he explained, "to go to France for my lunch, but I am delighted to have someone to lunch with me. You see, I had to send the beast, the Marquis, over with his bomb, because the President had his eye on me, though God knows how. I'll tell you the story some day. It was perfectly choking. Whenever I tried to slip out of it, I saw the President somewhere, smiling out of a bow window of a club or taking off his hat to me from the top of an omnibus. I tell you, you can say what you like. That fellow sold himself to the devil. He can be in six places at once." "So you sent the Marquis off, I understand," asked the professor. "Was it long ago? Shall we be in time to catch him?" "Yes," answered the new guide. "I've timed it all. He'll still be at Calais when we arrive." "But when we do catch him at Calais," said the professor, "what are we going to do?" At this question, the countenance of Dr. Bull fell for the first time. He reflected a little and then said, "Theoretically, I suppose we ought to call the police." "Not I," said Syme. "Theoretically, I ought to drown myself first. I promised a poor fellow who was a real modern pessimist, on my word of honor, not to tell the police. I'm no hand at casuistry, but I can't break my word to a modern pessimist. It's like breaking one's word to a child." "I'm in the same boat," said the professor. I tried to tell the police and I couldn't because of some silly oath I took. You say when I was an actor, I was a sort of all-round beast. Perjury or treason is the only crime I haven't committed. If I did that, I shouldn't know the difference between right and wrong. I've been through all that, said Dr. Bull, and I've made up my mind. I gave my promise to the secretary. You know him, man who smiles upside down. My friends, that man is the most utterly unhappy man that was ever human. It may be his digestion, or his conscience, or his nerves, or his philosophy of the universe, but he's damned. He's in hell. Well, I can't turn on a man like that and hunt him down. It's like whipping a leper. I may be mad, but that's how I feel, and there's jolly well the end of it. I don't think you're mad, said Syme. I knew you would decide like that when you first you... Eh, said Dr. Bull, when first you took off your spectacles. Dr. Bull smiled a little and strolled across the deck to look at the sunlit sea. Then he strolled back again, kicking his heels carelessly, and a companionable silence fell between the three men. Well, said Syme, it seems that we have all the same kind of morality, or immorality, so we had better face the fact that comes of it. Yes, assented the professor, you're quite right, and we must hurry up, for I can see the gray nose standing out from France. The fact that comes of it, said Syme seriously, is this, that we three are alone on this planet. Gogol has gone, God knows where. Perhaps the president has smashed him like a fly. On the council, we are three men against three, like the Romans who held the bridge. But we are worse off than that, first because they can appeal to their organization, and we cannot appeal to ours. And second because one of those other three men, said the professor, is not a man. Syme nodded and was silent for a second or two, and then he said, My idea is this. We must do something to keep the Marquis in Calais till tomorrow midday. I have turned over 20 schemes in my head. We cannot denounce him as a dynamiter. That is agreed. We cannot get him detained on some trivial charge, for we should have to appear. He knows us, and he would smell a rat. We cannot pretend to keep him on anarchist business. He might swallow much in that way, but not the notion of stopping in Calais while the Tsar went safely through Paris. We might try to kidnap him and lock him up ourselves, but he is a well-known man here. He has a whole bodyguard of friends. He is very strong and brave, and the event is doubtful. The only thing I can see to do is actually take advantage of the very things that are in the Marquis's favor. I am going to profit by the fact that he is a highly respected nobleman. I am going to profit by the fact that he has many friends and moves in the best society. What the devil are you talking about? Asked the professor. The Symes are first mentioned in the 14th century, said Syme, but there is a tradition that one of them rode behind Bruce at Bannockburn. Since 1350, the tree is quite clear. He's gone off his head, said the little doctor, staring. Our bearings, continued Syme calmly, are Argent, the Chevron, Gules, charged with three crosslets on the field. The motto varies. The professor seized Syme roughly by the waistcoat. We are just inshore, he said. Are you seasick or joking in the wrong place? My remarks are almost painfully practical, answered Syme in an unhurried manner. The house of St. Eustache also is very ancient. The Marquis cannot deny that he is a gentleman. He cannot deny that I am a gentleman. And in order to put the matter of my social position quite beyond a doubt, I propose at the earliest opportunity to knock his hat off. But here we are in the harbor. They went on shore under the strong sun in a sort of daze. Syme, who had now taken the lead as Bull had taken it in London, led them along a kind of marine parade until he came to some calves, embowered in a bulk of greenery and overlooking the sea. As he went before them, his step was slightly swaggering, and he swung his stick like a sword. He was making apparently for the extreme end of the line of calves, but he stopped abruptly. With a sharp gesture, he motioned them to silence. Then he pointed with one gloved finger to a calf's stable, under a bank of flowering foliage at which sat the Marquis de Saint-Eustache, his teeth shining in his thick black beard, and his bold brown face shadowed by a light yellow straw hat and outlined against the violet sea. Chapter 10. The Duel. Sime sat down at the calf stable with his companions, his blue eyes sparkling like the bright sea below, and ordered a bottle of Samur with a pleased impatience. He was, for some reason, in a condition of curious hilarity. His spirits were already unnaturally high. They rose as the Samur sank, and in half an hour his talk was a torrent of nonsense. He professed to be making out a plan of the conversation which was going to ensue between himself and the deadly Marquis. He jotted it down wildly with a pencil. It was arranged like a printed catechism with questions and answers, and was delivered with an extraordinary rapidity of utterance. I shall approach. Before taking off his hat, I shall take off my own. I shall say, the Marquis de St. Eustache, I believe. He will say, the celebrated Mr. Sime, I presume. He will say in the most exquisite French, how are you? I shall reply in the most exquisite Cockney. Oh, just the Sime. Oh, shut up, said the man in spectacles. Pull yourself together and chuck away that bit of paper. What are you really going to do? But it was a lovely catechism, said Sime pathetically. Do let me read it to you. It has only 43 questions and answers, and some of the Marquis's answers are wonderfully witty. I like to be just to my enemy. But what's the good of it all? Asked Dr. Bull in exasperation. It leads up to my challenge, don't you see? Said Sime, beaming. When the Marquis has given the 39th reply, which runs, has it by any chance occurred to you, asked the professor with a ponderous simplicity, that the Marquis may not say all the 43 things you have put down for him? In that case, I understand, your own epigrams may appear somewhat more forced. Sime struck the table with a radiant face. Why, how true that is, he said, and I never thought of it, sir. You have an intellect beyond the common. You will make a name. Oh, you're as drunk as an owl, said the doctor. It only remains, continued Sime, quite unperturbed, to adopt some other method of breaking the ice, if I may so express it, between myself and the man I wish to kill. And since the course of a dialogue cannot be predicted by one of its parties alone, as you have pointed out with such recondite acumen, the only thing to be done, I suppose, is for the one party, as far as possible, to do all the dialogue by himself. And so I will, by George. And he stood up suddenly, his yellow hair blowing in the slight sea breeze. A band was playing in a calf's chantant, hidden somewhere among the trees, and a woman had just stopped singing. On Sime's heated head, the bray of the brass band seemed like the jar and jingle of that barrel organ in Leicester Square, to the tune of which he had once stood up to die. He looked across to the little table where the Marquis sat. The man had two companions now, solemn Frenchmen in frock coats and silk hats, one of them with the red rosette of the Legion of Honor, evidently people of a solid social position. Besides these black cylindrical costumes, the Marquis in his loose straw hat and light spring clothes looked bohemian and even barbaric. But he looked the Marquis. Indeed, one might say that he looked the king, with his animal elegance, his scornful eyes, and his proud head lifted against the purple sea. But he was no Christian king, at any rate. He was, rather, some swarthy despot, half Greek, half Asiatic, who, in the days when slavery seemed natural, looked down on the Mediterranean, on his galley and his groaning slaves. Just so, Sime thought, would the brown-gold face of such a tyrant have shone against the dark green olives and the burning blue. "Are you going to dress the meeting?" asked the professor peevishly, seeing that Sime still stood up without moving. Sime drained his last glass of sparkling wine. "I am," he said, pointing across to the Marquis and his companions. That meeting displeases me. I am going to pull that meeting's great, ugly, mahogany-colored nose." He stepped across swiftly, if not quite steadily. The Marquis, seeing him, arched his black Assyrian eyebrows in surprise, but smiled politely. "You are Mr. Sime, I think," he said. Sime bowed. and you are the Marquis de St. Eustache," he said gracefully. "Permit me to pull your nose." He leaned over to do so, but the Marquis started backwards, upsetting his chair, and the two men in top hats held Syme back by the shoulders. "This man has insulted me," said Syme with gestures of explanation. "Insulted you?" cried the gentleman with the red rosette. "When?" "Oh, just now," said Syme recklessly. "He insulted my mother." "Insulted your mother?" exclaimed the gentleman incredulously. "Well, anyhow," said Syme, conceding a point, "my aunt." "But how can the Marquis have insulted your aunt just now?" said the second gentleman with some legitimate wonder. "He has been sitting here all the time." "Ah, it was what he said," said Syme darkly. "I said nothing at all," said the Marquis, "except something about the band. I only said that I liked Wagner played well." "It was an allusion to my family," said Syme firmly. "My aunt played Wagner badly. It was a painful subject. We are always being insulted about it." "This seems most extraordinary," said the gentleman, who was de Cors, looking doubtfully at the Marquis. "Oh, I assure you," said Syme earnestly, "the whole of your conversation was simply packed with sinister allusions to my aunt's weaknesses." "This is nonsense," said the second gentleman. "I, for one, have said nothing for half an hour except that I like the singing of the girl with the black hair." "Well, there you are again," said Syme indignantly. "My aunt's was red." "It seems to me," said the other, "that you are simply seeking a pretext to insult the Marquis." "By George," said Syme, facing round and looking at him, "what a clever chap you are." The Marquis started up with eyes flaming like a tiger's. "Seeking a quarrel with me," he cried, "seeking a fight with me. By God, there was never a man who had to seek long. These gentlemen will perhaps act for me. There are still 4 hours of daylight. Let us fight this evening." Syme bowed with a quite beautiful graciousness. "Marquis," he said, "your action is worthy of your fame and blood. Permit me to consult for a moment with the gentleman in whose hands I shall place myself." In 3 long strides, he rejoined his companions, and they who had seen his champagne-inspired attack and listened to his idiotic explanations were quite startled at the look of him. For now that he came back to them, he was quite sober, a little pale, and he spoke in a low voice of passionate practicality. "I have done it," he said hoarsely. "I have fixed a fight on the beast. But look here and listen carefully. There's no time for talk. You are my seconds, and everything must come from you. Now you must insist, and insist absolutely, on the duel coming off after 7 tomorrow, so as to give me the chance of preventing him from catching the 7:45 for Paris. If he misses that, he misses his crime. He can't refuse to meet you on such a small point of time and place. But this is what he will do. He will choose a field somewhere near a wayside station where he can pick up the train. He is a very good swordsman, and he will trust to killing me in time to catch it. But I can fence well, too, and I think I can keep him in play, at any rate until the train is lost. Then perhaps he may kill me to console his feelings. You understand? Very well, then, let me introduce you to some charming friends of mine." And leading them across the parade, he presented them to the Marquis's seconds by 2 very aristocratic names of which they had not previously heard. Syme was subject to spasms of singular common sense, not otherwise a part of his character. They were, as he said of his impulse about the spectacles, poetic intuitions, and they sometimes rose to the exaltation of prophecy. He had correctly calculated in this case the policy of his opponent. While the Marquis was informed by his seconds that Syme could only fight in the morning, he must fully have realized that an obstacle had suddenly arisen between him and his bomb-throwing business in the capital. Naturally, he could not explain this objection to his friends, so he chose the course which Syme had predicted. He induced his seconds to settle on a small meadow not far from the railway, and he trusted to the fatality of the first engagement. When he came down very coolly to the field of honor, no one could have guessed that he had any anxiety about a journey. His hands were in his pockets, his straw hat on the back of his head, his handsome face brazen in the sun. But it might have struck a stranger as odd that there appeared in his train not only his seconds carrying the sword case, but 2 of his servants carrying a portmanteau and a luncheon basket. Early as was the hour, the sun soaked everything in warmth, and Sime was vaguely surprised to see so many spring flowers burning gold and silver in the tall grass, in which the whole company stood almost knee-deep. With the exception of the Marquis, all the men were in somber,